This is the legal disclaimer, where I tell you that the views, thoughts, and opinions shared in this podcast belong solely to our guests and hosts, and not necessarily Brady or Brady's affiliates. Please note, this podcast contains discussions of violence that some people may find disturbing. It's okay. We find it disturbing, too. Welcome back to another episode of Red, Blue, and Brady.
Hi, I'm Kelly.
And I'm JJ.
And today we're joined by a new Brady member, but an old voice on the podcast, Ted Bonar.
Yes, Ted has been on several episodes of Red, Blue, and Brady, and he is the new director of Brady's End Family Fire program. And we're going to talk about all of that, you know, in today's episode.
Yeah, and we're also joined by a great gun violence prevention advocate, Kristen McGinnis, who has spent over a decade educating people about firearm suicide prevention. And she herself is a survivor of firearm suicide attempt in 2010.
But I think it was just so brave of her to come on and talk about what is such a rare experience. You know, she's had extensive injuries that she's had to overcome to her face and her jaw, which, I mean, even today is impacting her life and her speech and has led to a long road of recovery. I mean, she's had almost 50 surgeries. And so the fact that she spent over a decade working for gun violence prevention and being so brave is just amazing. And all four of us, and well, actually technically six of us, if you count Kristen and Ted's dogs who do make an appearance, we gathered together to talk about Kristen's story, the myths surrounding suicide, and how gun owners and non-gun owners alike can better protect against family fire.
Yeah, just a warning for some of our listeners, the topics that we're going to discuss today, depression, isolation, and firearm suicide, are hard topics and they may be triggering. So please take care of yourselves and listen cautiously.
Yeah, I feel like it's hard to give trigger warnings on a podcast like this, but it's definitely necessary. Remember, folks, that we always link to a variety of resources in the description of each episode. So please go ahead and take advantage of that this time. All right, can you two introduce yourselves?
Hi, I'm Ted Bonar and I'm a clinical psychologist and I'm the director of End Family Fire. And Family Fire is the program under Brady where our mission is to reduce the loss of life through the safe storage of firearms.
Thanks, Ted. And Kristen, how about you?
I'm Kristen McGinnis. I live in the Washington, D.C. metro area in Annandale, Virginia. I'm 52 years old, and I am really delighted to have this opportunity to talk about gun violence and what a dramatic effect it has on anyone who's ever in a situation that had to pull the trigger. I also believe in being as public as I can to reduce the stigma of mental illness and suicide. The more we talk about it, the better off everyone's going to be.
No, and I really want to thank you for sharing because, you know, as we've talked about, I there's a lot of things that Americans are uncomfortable talking about, right? And guns, suicide, mental health, like those are all things really at the top of the list. So I want to thank you for being so open with your story. You're a very brave lady.
Thank you. So, I come from good stock.
Now, in sort of the vein of sharing, of I'm going to ask you a really uncomfortable question, I think, but one that I think we have to start from, which is, are you comfortable telling our listeners about what happened in October of 2010?
Yeah. Leading up to October 22nd, 2010, I suffered a series of losses that were individually so devastating and piled one on top of the other. I heard someone describe it as the perfect storm to wind up being terribly depressed and anxious and suicidal eventually. 2009, in May, I got fired from my job that I had for 18 years. And that sent me into a tailspin because I was all about my career for this nonprofit and not having it anymore. I didn't know what to do next. I also lost my golden retriever, Sandy. She was 16 and she lived a really long and happy life. But that doesn't make the loss any easier. I was in such financial distress, I guess you could call it. I cashed in my 401k. And I moved in with a man I thought would be my husband. And after a few months, he told me to move out and I had to get my own place and started going through my savings really quickly. I lost my access to medical care, which meant I couldn't get my prescriptions for depression and anxiety. Then I moved into an apartment that was really nice, but probably exceeded what I should have had for the time. So I took a part-time job as a waitress, and I also took in a roommate. Well, the roommate was really bad news, turns out, and he would steal from me all the time. I was actually evicted from my apartment. My car was almost repossessed. I asked my parents for help, and they didn't realize how serious my situation was. So one morning after a night of being all night, up all night again, not being able to sleep, being jittery and panicked and just in a total meltdown, I decided I was done, just done with going on day to day. I was going to kill myself. And the gun I owned for my own safety and protection is a very powerful weapon. And I was confident that that would kill me instantly. The fact that it didn't is almost unheard of. I don't know if you've seen or are aware of the documentary Behind the Bullet that I got to do. Heidi Ewan is the producer and the director of that, and she found me. And after being vetted through my dad, who was highly suspicious of anyone who wanted to use me or exploit my situation. Well, that wasn't Heidi at all. Not at all. We were at a viewing of the documentary, and someone asked her, you know, why did you choose Kristen? And Heidi said, well, first of all, to shoot yourself in the head and survive is unheard of. And then Kristen was willing to talk to us. A lot of people either aren't able or unwilling to discuss their suicide attempt. And I realized early on that I didn't stay for a reason. And I think that this is my reason. Helping people with suicidal thoughts and a plan become used to talking about it and reaching out for help and then getting that help. So this is what I do now. I am currently disabled, which is a blessing and a curse. As you probably can figure out, unrelated to this, 3 years ago, I was diagnosed with neuropathy. So you'll see some of my posts about struggling with that on top of everything else I've gone through. But now I'm in such a better place in my life that dealing with a disease like neuropathy and the depression and anxiety that will plague me if I don't stay on the medication. Well, it's just a lot to take on, you know? One of those moving experiences I had was a girl contacted me through Facebook and said, I was online researching the best ways to kill myself, and I realized that it would be with a gun. And then I found your story, and I started reading everything I could find on you. And I decided I wasn't going to kill myself. I was going to reach out for help instead. And that chokes me up even now, because I'm just so happy that there's so many out there that is going to benefit from my horrible experience, and they're going to make a better life for themselves.
That story and you helping somebody helps us so much, because it's the bookend of your experience, right?
Exactly.
That in a suicide crisis, it can be something that is managed, that you can help somebody get through. It doesn't solve all of the problems right away. It doesn't magically, you might hear my dog woofing in the background. It doesn't solve all problems or take away all of the pain right away. Mm-hmm. But that moment, it doesn't have to be impulsive. It can be managed in the hour or the day or the 5 minutes where it's bad. And you can help somebody through that. And that can be the difference and whether somebody makes a suicide attempt. I really appreciate that.
In a few previous interviews, you talked about how you isolated yourself from others as your depression grew. Can you talk about how and why that happened and how it impacted you?
Yeah. When I got fired from a job, I had a lot of good friends, and they were worried about me, knowing that I was taking all these hits one after another. And at the beginning of 2010, I decided that I wanted to go back to school to become a medical assistant. Well, that was challenging. My ultimate goal was to be a nurse. And part of that drive was seeing the people who had been so instrumental in my recovery. I wanted to do that same thing and bring those same qualities to healthcare. So the program was challenging, and I threw myself into it with gusto. And I spent all my time studying or preparing and getting straight A's all the way through. But withdrawing from everyone had serious consequences on my overall well-being. I like to think of myself as a very cheery, optimistic person. And I didn't like the thought of how depressed I really felt. I felt like I was at rock bottom and digging. I didn't know when that would stop. So by October, I was basically not in contact with anybody face-to-face. There was one occasion. My girlfriend had a birthday party in October. And I went out, and it was really fun all-nighter. And as I was leaving, Lynn said, "Krista, are you okay? I can't face losing you." And I said, "Oh, no, I'm fine. Well, 5 days later, I shot myself. And Lynn was devastated. I lost a lot of friends, people I thought would be in my life forever. They can't handle what I did to myself. I know that that probably sheds light on some of their own issues. And maybe they're afraid that I'll confront them about those. I don't know. I don't fully understand why so many people abandoned me. But I am in the process of making new lifetime friends now and all the time. And that's what I'm choosing to focus on. Knowing that I received such love and affection and attention in the past, that's a happy memory. And now going forward, I'm engaged to the most amazing man. We've been dating for 9 years. I met him through my favorite nurse at Fairfax Hospital. And 2 years ago, he proposed, and now I'm living with him and his elderly mom and his 14-year-old son. And I'm thriving. I love it here. I have a rescue doggy. Here's Lexi. Good Lexi. And a cat. And they hang out with me all day during the day. And it's just a really soft place for me to land.
That's so wonderful. I'm so happy to hear that you're thriving.
Yeah, I am. I am. Part of my recovery has been to let my parents know how I'm doing. My dad, he had a deal with me. He said, "Kristen, we will take care of everything. You focus on healing." Well, I began writing them an email entry, like a journal entry, every single day for the past, 12 years. And I've always found writing to be a very cathartic experience. And it's especially useful for going back and putting myself back in that dark place I was at the time and leading myself out of it. I like to give the analogy that the fall to a suicidal state is like jumping off a cliff. It happens fast. And then you land and you don't know what the hell to do. The climb back out is arduous and tedious. And there's some days you think, "I can't do this anymore." Well, I never feel like that anymore because I recognize that dark road. And when I'm climbing and having trouble, I reached out to my lifelines, and they tie a knot, and they can hang on. And having that support, that overwhelming unconditional love, I can't think of a better way to recover and get to a new normal.
And I think it's also helpful. I mean, it's so hard to hear what happened with the friends that you had at the time, but I know that this episode will help people know better how to support friends too.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. I saw a Facebook meme recently where it was, when a person is depressed, hear all the things that they don't want to hear. And it was, you know, why can't you just snap out of it? I would cheer up. It could be so much worse. You've got it better than lots of other people. Why do you feel so bad about your situation? None of those comments are helpful. When I was going through my devastating losses in 2009, I quickly picked up on who had lost someone very close to them because they would encourage me to talk about what happened.
Yeah, Ali Brosh actually has a really amazing comic about this I can share with you, just about how people want to say the right thing, but they don't know what to say, and they feel like they have to say something, and it turns into a mess.
So, but first of all, Kristen, I want to say how much I appreciate you sharing your story, so that we can learn and understand and talk about suicide. And so, the more we do this, the more comfortable we get.
Yes.
I think the better off we are as a culture and as a society.
Yeah.
So that we can help other people who've been down this road. You know, I have a couple of thoughts from what you've shared so powerfully.
Yeah.
You know, the idea of a person being selfish or weak.
Yeah.
Or that it's a cop out.
Yeah.
I'll amplify the myth of that. As a clinical psychologist who's worked in, if you're a therapist, you work with people who think about suicide. And
yes.
They have attempted suicide.
Yes.
I've been in this for a little bit. And, you know, in my experience, people, I think you described it beautifully, so well and powerfully, that somebody who thinks about suicide, somebody that goes to a place where they're in that much pain, that person is among the strongest type of people that I've ever met.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a small amount of strength to walk through your day or week or month or years.
Yeah.
Thinking about suicide or death, yeah, or that there's no hope or there's no, yeah, you know, the strength is almost unspeakably large. It's profound, yeah, right?
Yeah. Well, and I think what you both are talking about, and what even I think Kelly mentioned earlier, is, you know, sort of these myths that surround suicide and firearm suicide in particular.
Well, first of all, it's not depression that led to my suicide attempt. It was anxiety. The anxiety was the thing that would keep my mind spinning with endless questions and dark thoughts and wondering how the hell I was going to make anything get better in my life. That was why when I decided I was done, I thought, okay, yeah, I'm not going to take pills because somebody might find me and resuscitate me, or you know, I might throw up all the pills. That happens a lot. I'm not going to split my wrist because, well, ow. A gun, that's fast and usually fatal. I chose to go out onto the balcony to shoot myself. And the reason was I knew that that bullet could easily go through my head and through the wall to the next apartment. And I didn't want that to happen. On the balcony, there are 4x4 beams. And so if the bullet left my head, it would get stuck in one of those. So, yeah, as to being selfish, that's probably the number one reason that people don't know me anymore, because they see what I did is the ultimate cop-out, ultimate lack of personal responsibility, the ultimate way to leave behind a world of issues and mess and gore to clean up. How dare you? What makes you think you're so much better than everybody else that you get to choose your way out and run away and escape from every issue or problem or obstacle that you might be facing? I faced all those obstacles head on. I saw them as a challenge, an opportunity to learn something, to make myself better. Well, in that morning, I decided that I already learned more than I needed to know about not being able to overcome these obstacles. And my velvet bulldozer approach to life wasn't working anymore. I didn't write a suicide note. I thought about it. I didn't know what to say. You know, what? I'm going to write, I'm just done? Bang. I did get a little angel figurine that Lynn and George had brought me. And Lynn was the friend who said, you didn't want to lose me. I took the little angel and I held that in my hand. And I prayed, asking God to accept me into heaven. My mom says that when she came to the hospital, she thought that she could find I had been shot by my roommate or something else. She didn't believe I tried to shoot myself. And it wasn't until she saw me holding my hands up to my head in a nightmarish state of, you know, I'm told that often when somebody suffers a serious injury, they replay it in their heads over and over again. And I was doing that in the bed, in the hospital bed. Yeah.
And I think that leads into something else that I wanted to talk about with, there's a couple other things I wanted to mention, but you've talked so much about depression. And then just recently you said it was really the anxiety.
Yeah.
I think that it really, it's so important to hear your story, because if suicide were as easy as treating depression or anxiety, well, we would have made a lot more progress on helping people with suicide. The truth is, there are a lot of people who experience depression and or anxiety, and most of them aren't thinking about suicide, or if they are, it doesn't get to the point of thinking about taking their life, because that's
right.
So there is more about suicide than just mental illness. So when our culture starts talking about suicide and somebody immediately goes to, oh, well, we have to improve mental health care. Well, I won't argue that.
Right.
I would like there to be more people in better types of therapy. Sure. That's what I do.
Yeah.
But there's so much more that, you know, suicide has, there are more aspects about suicide, and you and your story includes these other things about financial stress.
Yeah.
Or loss of relationship.
Yeah.
Or chronic pain, which you just talked about. You know, that these go, that, you know, that's not a diagnosis.
Right.
I mean, chronic pain is, but, you know, the loss of a job and having a hard time paying your bills, that's not a diagnosis.
Right.
And you get all of those together and somebody might end up with a condition called depression or anxiety, but they can be independent of that.
Right.
So what happens with suicide, you know, from a clinical perspective, is people are in pain and they want to be out of pain.
Yeah.
Right? Like, if we really break it down to basics, it's not about a mental health problem. It's an I don't want to be in pain anymore problem. Right?
Absolutely.
Did that sound right, Kristen?
That's absolutely spot on, yes. Is the road to that dark place.
Yeah.
The scary part is when somebody gets a plan. That's a key word for somebody landing in the artist's room. Do you have a plan how to kill yourself? If the answer is yes, that's your mental health crisis right there. That's a red flag. That person needs help immediately. I'm sorry.
No. I love it. I want to kind of merge in another idea that you didn't mention, but I think it's in what you're talking about, and it's another myth about suicide. People talk about suicide as impulsive.
Yeah.
But you just clarified a couple of things. Like you right now just talked about having a plan.
Yeah.
And then earlier you talked about you made a decision. And there was a little, and it happened quickly.
Yes, it.
It happened quickly between your decision and when you took action.
Yes.
But I think it's really important. There's something here that I really want to amplify. That's what you've described to me doesn't land under the definition of impulsive.
Uh-huh.
It may have happened fast, but it's also something that we can plan for.
Right.
That we can say somebody's going to have a hard time.
Uh-huh.
How do we help somebody that's going to the dark place? How do we help them navigate when it gets bad? We know it's going to get bad, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
If we use the word impulsive, there's this idea that we can't do anything about it.
Yeah. And that's such bad framing because there's so much we can do. You know, we're doing it now. Like Kristen, you sharing your story now is helping.
Every time I tell my story, I heal.
Mm-hmm.
When I help somebody else, that's a big piece of the puzzle right there. I heal.
Sure. A big part of, and for the other person, I think a big part of why you might be able to help them is that they feel a little bit less alone when you connect with them, right?
Yeah.
And that can be the difference in that moment of suicide, right? So if suicide is about, I'm in pain and I would rather not be in pain.
Right.
Or I would like to be in less pain.
Yeah.
Being connected with somebody is a way to feel less pain, right? And, you know, your story and in the suicide prevention world, we call this lived experience, right?
Okay.
And how important it is that a person like yourself with lived experience share your story and share your story with others, mm-hmm. because other people that have felt this way need to feel less alone.
Yes.
If you feel less alone, you feel a little less in pain.
Uh-huh.
And that can be the thing that turns into hope. That may take some time.
Yeah.
And it doesn't happen overnight. For some people, it might happen overnight. But that's the value of your story and why somebody in a hospital bed might talk to you before they talk to me or somebody else, right?
Yeah.
That they're going to be able to connect with you in a different way. So powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, it's been an honor and a blessing that I can use this horrific experience to reach out and say to somebody, I've been in that dark place and help you get out. I'll hold your hand and we'll walk together. And I do. I reach out and I hold their hand.
Yeah.
That usually leads to an emotional outburst and pouring, which I welcome. Bring it on.
Which might be one of the most important when they can really sense and have that visceral connection with somebody. And that's when they feel not alone.
Yeah.
For some people, it might be something else, but for some people, that's the not alone that helps them feel understood and in less pain.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. I also want to say that just because I've come this far doesn't mean I don't still struggle every single day. I have some days where all I can do is get by 5 minutes at a time. And I have other moments where I'm like, woohoo, look how great things are now. But recovery is an ongoing process, whether you're an alcoholic or a drug user or battered wife or any number of horrible things that might have happened to you. Recovery is every single moment that you're still alive.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Kristen.
So in the time that we have together, I'm wondering if we could talk a little bit about the specific role of firearms in your story. And Kristen, you had been a gun owner for many years. So can we talk a little bit about your gun ownership and if you're still a gun owner?
Those are great questions. The gun was given to me a long time ago by my boyfriend at the time. He owned a lot of guns. And I was really hesitant to have those in the house where I'd be living because I didn't know very much about using a gun. So so Cliff had me go to an NRA training session that was specific for men. And I learned to not be comfortable with guns. but confident that I could use it properly. My life was threatened. And he gave me that gun in particular because with other guns, like a 22 or even a 38, that might not stop them from coming at you. But a 357, they're not going to be able to do as much. And if nothing else, it gives you a few seconds to get away. So I became a lifetime member of the NRA. And I know a lot of people who have good experience with knowing how to use a firearm properly. For example, one of my friends from childhood was the firearms expert for the Marines. And he lives up here now. So I had him take me to the range several times. And we would practice pulling the gun out of my concealed carry bag and firing and being accustomed to the noise and the bang and the flash and the kick. So I was confident about my gun use. I know now that I can't have a gun of my own. There are guns in the house right now, and I loved Ted's talking about safe storage because that was one of my requirements before I could move in here. David doesn't want to sell the guns because he doesn't want them ever to be used by somebody else to hurt someone. He wants them gone. And we have suspicions about guns that are sent to be destroyed, that they aren't, and they may wind up in the possession of someone who's going to hurt someone. So I think it's very wise that he has that perspective because, quite honestly, Cliff is one of my favorite exes, and he still has a big role in my life. When he learned that I shot myself with that gun, it devastated him to his very core. And even now, he has a hard time knowing where I am in my life. His life on recovery, you know, it's nothing but the best for me. But for him, that individual responsibility. And oh my God, if I hadn't given her that gun, maybe she wouldn't have killed herself, tried to kill herself. I dated a former Marine, there's no such thing as an ex-Marine, but an inactive Marine for several years at the beginning of my recovery. This was during the time that I couldn't talk, eat, or drink because I blew half my face off. And Ryan was this constant source of comfort and understanding. And the first time I went over to his house, he had his gun on the nightstand for use in case there was an intruder. I couldn't look at that gun. I knew that if I had access, I would pick it up and use it again. That's a dark place. That's why every single day is recovery. So Ryan, I mean, I said, you got to put that away right now, or I wrote it. And he did. He locked up all his firearms. And eventually, I got to the state of healing where I could see that gun out on his nightstand, and it didn't trigger that reaction in me. It took a long time for me to cancel my lifetime membership with the NRA. they continue to send me stuff for years, and I'd write back and say, you know, please stop. I really hate the NRA now where it is. It's more of a, they don't preach gun safety enough, and they don't acknowledge gun violence enough. Knowing where I am in my life, I can't do anything but talk about gun violence prevention. And no one like me, oh, there's something else I want to point out. You know what? Nobody thought I would kill myself with a gun until I'd done it. I seemed like the ultimate gun owner. I was confident. I was trained. I was capable. I practiced. And I had gone through a lot of depressing things, sure, but why would she use that gun to hurt herself? That doesn't make any sense. No, I'm not pressing. She's too strong. She's too happy. She's too, you know, she'll get through all of this, no problem. Well, I didn't. And no one can estimate what a person's breaking point is. I could barely do it for myself. So having a mandatory waiting period for guns is a great idea. I think that it eliminates a lot of the acts of passion, gun violence. And the more that we talk about gun violence prevention in the home and and other aspects of your life, the importance of not having ready access to a lethal tool is critical for us as a people, as a country, as individuals, as family and friends. We need to get to that place, like I am, and I will help lead anybody there.
Yeah, and Kristen, I'd love to comment on that, because I kind of want to synthesize a few different things that you talked about there, because I think you really made such a perfect, it's a perfect portrait of what we want End Family Fire to be.
Yeah.
That it's, End Family Fire isn't about
stripping guns. It's not about that. Yeah.
Right. No. And it's about safe storage. But the reason, the reason I want to emphasize that is, you spoke so, you shared this other part of your story, which is like how you became comfortable and confident using a weapon.
Yes.
And that you knew how effective it would be.
Yes.
And well, this is a reason some people choose to use a firearm for suicide. And we know how effective guns are. In the suicide attempt. And so part of it is comfortable with the weapon and the tool, the mechanism of it, and the knowledge of what it will do,
right,
and the practice of it, and if we put that together, this other part of your story, that other people knew you were like, well, that she would never do that. She's a great gun owner, right?
Yeah.
This is an important piece that we know that safety is a value of gun owners.
Yes.
That gun owners will value safety.
Yes.
And there's a couple of pieces here that's hard to put together.
Mm-hmm.
Gun owners know how dangerous guns are.
Yeah.
And they will know that they are lethal weapons.
Right.
If used for that purpose, that when they're used for that purpose, they are.
Yeah.
And therefore, there are higher rates of suicide and unintentional shootings and et cetera.
Yeah.
And then and this is by research. This isn't me judging. This is me stating the things we know.
Yeah.
Most gun owners will attribute that risk to other people.
Yeah.
They won't attribute it to themselves or the people that they know. And that's understandable, right?
It is.
Because you've practiced on the range and you understand how weapons are used. And so you know that they're dangerous.
Yeah.
And so there's almost a cognitive dissonance there where like, I know that guns are dangerous, but if I have a gun, I know how to keep it so that I'm not in danger of suicide
or
unintentional shooting.
Right.
And yet the statistics tell us that so it's not a, like the statistic isn't personal, but the statistics still matter, right?
Yes, they do.
This is why, and if we combine that idea, forgive me, I know I'm on a bit of a tangent here. It's not really a tangent. if we put that idea together with the idea that suicide really isn't impulsive.
Right.
This is where we get to the place like, you know what, if we get to improving safe storage practices at home, somebody has a chance to have that dark place moment.
Yeah.
And there is time and space in between them and the usable firearm. And that's what can be the difference between somebody living or dying.
Yeah.
Right. And so
absolutely.
That's what I'm trying. That's what we're trying to put on. Now it took me 4 minutes to synthesize those ideas. You did it more quickly and better than I did it, but that's the point, right? That safe storage isn't about gun control. Safe storage is about how is it stored in the home. When something happens and it's a crisis, if you need it to access it for personal defense, okay, let's find the right storage system for you.
Yeah.
The right safe storage system for you.
Yeah.
And if that safe storage system slows down a problem when a person is in a suicide crisis, then job well done.
Yeah.
Right. That's what we're trying to get at in End Family Fire.
Yeah.
Kristen, did I say that well, Kristen?
You nailed it.
I hope so.
Yeah. No, you really did. And I think Perhaps the difference between my explanation and yours is that I'm talking from a place within myself.
Yeah.
You're talking from a viewpoint of someone who's been able to stand back and analyze it and consolidate your different experiences with different patients.
Yeah.
I hope you never get to that dark place. I hope that you have enough training to reach out and find someone in your lifeline.
That's a beautiful message, Kristen. I really appreciate that. Thank you.
Well, and I want to thank you too so much, Kristen and Ted, both of you for being with Kelly and I today. And I think to close out, maybe the best thing I can do is to give folks some resources. I mean, as always, they're linked in the description of this episode, but just if folks need them or just want to know that they're there, I think it's helpful just to have these numbers with you. You can always call the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline at 1-800, so that's 800-273-8255. They also have an online chat feature at suicidepreventionlifeline.org. You can also always use the crisis text line just by texting hello, the word hello, at 741741. And again, thank you both so much for your time. All right. And now this is the moment in the podcast where, for the sake of levity in our brains, we bring you unbelievable stories and debunked myths. And man, have we got a doozy today.
Considering that we have a doozy every week, I'm probably not going to like where this ends up going.
You might end up liking where this is going. How do you feel about boats?
I mean, I'm generally a fan. Yeah.
Yeah. Not anti-boat? Okay, well, yeah. So as many of our listeners know, the NRA, the National Rifle Association, is currently undergoing its deposition stage of its bankruptcy case in Dallas. And Kelly, as a lawyer, you know, depositions can be fun because that's where you learn all sorts of interesting details. And as part of that, the NRA's leader, Wayne LaPierre, has been giving testimony.
What did he have to say for himself?
Well, he had a lot to say, actually. I have a feeling we're going to be covering his deposition quite a bit in this section. But for today, LaPierre reported that he was so afraid for his safety 6 months after the Sandy Hook shooting that he just had to take refuge aboard a friend's luxury yacht called The Illusion.
I mean, the yacht is called The Illusions, and I feel like the jokes just write themselves. Like, all we got to do is just put that out there.
Yeah, and I would also like to point out that the yacht came with a fully stocked kitchen, a cook, at least two other full-time staff, and two water scooters, because that's what you need.
To feel safe, right? That was his justification. Mr. The, you know, guns are first freedom. That was his justification?
Yes, because, and I quote, this was the one place that I hope I could feel safe, where I remember getting there going, thank God I'm safe, nobody can get me here. And that's how it happened. That's why I used it, end quote.
Seems to really contradict a lot of messaging that he has put out there in the past about safety and firearms. Like, we're just going to start telling Americans the only thing that stops a bad guy with a gun is a yacht. And if so, yachts for everyone? Like, I'm really curious how this all works.
That's, I think, the new message. Yachts for everyone.
Yep. In news this week, some good news to report.
That is very nice to hear. I like good news.
Yeah, and this is pretty great. So this week, President Biden revealed 6 actions to address America's gun violence epidemic. These actions are the following. The Justice Department, within 30 days, will issue a proposed rule to help stop the proliferation of ghost guns. The Justice Department, within 60 days, will issue a proposed rule to make clear when a device marketed as a stabilizing brace effectively turns a pistol into a short-barreled rifle subject to the requirements of the National Firearms Act. And within 60 days, the Justice Department will also publish model, quote, red flag, or what we call extreme risk protection order legislation for states.
Yes. The administration is also going to invest in evidence-based community violence interventions as 5 federal agencies make changes to 26 different programs to direct vital support to community violence intervention programs as quickly as possible. and is going to issue a new comprehensive report on firearms trafficking and annual updates necessary to give policymakers the information they need to help address firearms trafficking today. And all that information, plus everything that Kelly just talked about, if you need more details on that for it to be really broken down, head to BradyUnited.org. We've got explanations of everything that, I mean, I happen to think are quite good.
Yeah. And we also have some podcast episodes.
We do.
Yeah. And kind of on that note, President Biden is also nominating friend of the podcast, an amazing human, David Chipman, to serve as the director of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms, which has not had a confirmed director since 2015.
Yes, you can hear David on two of our previous podcasts. I have him linked in the descriptor, like always, and I cannot think of a better person to lead up the ATF. So this is great to see movement on this issue. Hey, want to share with the podcast? Listeners are now get in touch with us here at Red, Blue, and Brady via phone or text message. Simply call or text us at 480-744-3452 with your thoughts, questions, concerns, ideas, whatever. Kelly and I are standing by.
Thanks for listening. As always, Brady's life-saving work in Congress, the courts, and communities across the country is made possible thanks to you. For more information on Brady or how to get involved in the fight against gun violence, please like and subscribe to the podcast. Get in touch with us at BradyUnited.org or on social at BradyBuzz. Be brave and remember, take action, not sides.